If you give farmers a market, they will figure it out. They are engineers at heart. They dream about stuff that most people can't believe you even think about. They will figure it out.
Welcome to the 392nd installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. It's no secret that diversifying farming operations out of the corn-soybean duoculture is key to building soil health. That's the ecological and agronomic side of the picture. But how do farmers step out of the row crop rut in a way that's profitable? After all, even the most soil-friendly practice is not sustainable in the long term if it doesn't pay off at the bank. LSB is grappling with that question via field days, workshops, and one-to-one meetings involving farmer members of our Soil Builders Network, which covers parts of Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. In recent years, members of this network, as well as other farmers in the upper Midwest, have shown interest in integrating a small grain like oats into the typical corn-soybean rotation. Oats actually have a long history in the Midwest, but in recent decades, corn and soybeans have crowded out just about any other third crop out there. As an export-driven system comes to dominate, markets consolidate, and government policy that emphasizes the production of row crops becomes more entrenched. The soil health benefits of a diversified rotation are pretty straightforward. A plant like oats has lots of fibrous roots that help build soil biology and aggregate structure. It relies less on chemical inputs like nitrogen fertilizer and also breaks up weed and insect pest cycles, thus lowering a farmer's reliance on pesticides. Finally, since oats are harvested in late summer, they can open up an early planting window for getting cover crops or a future forage crop established by fall. It doesn't hurt that although oats are no longer a major part of the typical Midwestern cropping regimen, most rural communities seem to have at least one or two farmers around who know how to raise and harvest them. That's all well and good, but the big reason oats have been garnering a lot of attention recently is because of the potential they offer for being a lucrative way to diversify and build soil health. It turns out the U.S. imports roughly 90% of the oats used for human consumption here, and demand for this healthy food is on a significant upward trend. That's why recently there have been some exciting efforts in the region to revitalize a local processing and marketing infrastructure for oats. For example, southeastern Minnesota farmer Martin Larson and other members of the so-called oat mafia have been banding together to find local markets for the crop. In addition, as I record this, a major oat processing facility is being built in Albert Lea, Minnesota. Scheduled to go online in August 2026, Green Acres Milling has 135 farmer investors. The brainchild of Iowa farmers Landon and Ann Plagey, Green Acres has the potential to profitably diversify the rotation on tens of thousands of acres in the region. No wonder whenever LSP holds a meeting related to small grains, it's standing room only. But what I find most exciting about the Oat Mafia and Green Acres endeavors is not that they're helping revitalize interest in this one specific small grain. After all, hitching our wagon to one so-called magic bullet crop is what's gotten farmers in trouble in the first place. What could be a real game changer is that a crop like oats provides an opportunity for commodity farmers used to producing for the livestock industry, the export-driven commodity market, or the biofuel industry to enter a world of raising food for direct human consumption. Just as oats can be a gateway crop for building soil health, they can also offer an entryway into connecting with eaters who are interested in health and the environment and are part of a marketing infrastructure that will pay farmers to produce a variety of food-grade crops in a soil-friendly manner. Food companies that emphasize healthy eating don't just need oats. They also desire other ingredients that can be raised right here in the Midwest. The idea that modifying the corn-soybean rotation just a little can open up other possibilities for diversifying a farmer's portfolio really struck me recently as I was having a conversation with Matt Kruger. Matt is the Director of Strategy and Development at Green Acres. Through that position, he works with the mills, farmer investors, as well as food companies looking to purchase oats for their products. He brings an interesting perspective to this position. Besides growing up on a southeastern Minnesota dairy farm, Matt also worked for a local soil and water conservation district office at a time when the soil health movement was taking off in the region. In addition, he recently spent 8 years at Land O'Lakes, where he assisted farmers in adopting soil health practices in hopes of helping them access markets that pay for sequestering carbon. And he and his wife Maggie, along with their 1-year-old Lyle, live on an 80-acre farm near Pine Island, Minnesota. During the past 5 years, they've been using diverse rotations of crops, cover cropping, and rotational grazing of a cow-calf herd to revitalize soil that had been pretty worn out by years of intensive corn-soybean production. In short, Matt is in a good position to see some of the opportunities available for getting rewarded in the marketplace when soil-friendly practices are adopted. But he's also aware of the agronomic and economic challenges farmers face when seeking to diversify. On a frigid January afternoon, I stopped by Matt's farm to chat with him about approaching soil-friendly farming through a food-grade lens. We also talked about how making that third crop profitable can help close the nutrient cycle in an environmentally and economically sustainable manner, and how, in some ways, the current state of the soil health movement provides a perfect opportunity to tap into the healthy food market. To Matt, it's all about building relationships, even if it means striking up a conversation with a truck driver at a gas station in Lime Springs, Iowa. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this idea of how farmers can make diversity pay off. I guess it's one of those ideas that everybody loves, you know, like puppies and apple pie, but it really does have to pay. And I'm wondering if we are at a moment where maybe some things are coming together where maybe we can start to make that pay a little bit.
Yeah, it's one of the goals of most farmers is, right, how we can not lose money farming and how we can make it pay. And like, if you think the beef side of it, right, do direct market, you sell your beef to a locker plant, you kind of have it sold before it's delivered type of deal. With grain, for oats, essentially that's exactly what we're trying to do, is cut out the middlemen. And we are building a mill, and it's owned by farmers, so that we can get, the mill's just going to operate in its space to cash flow. But really, it's not there to get rich. It's for the farmers to make money and actually grow a crop that fits in their rotation that is awesome for the environment, right? You plant oats the first day the ground is fit for it. So essentially, if you can drive a tractor across it, you should probably be planting oats. So we can get ahead of some of the weed pressure, right? So then just by dumb luck, we'll have less chemical use because of we're ahead of most wheats with canopy or just grass cover with those oats. And then we're harvesting the last week of July. It always turns out to be right on my birthday, too. My birthday's August 4th, so I'm always busy with oat harvest then, or making straw, as an example. So we're harvesting early, so then the opportunity to get a cover crop to grow, or if we interseed a cover crop, such as clover, with the oats, it's a silver bullet when it comes to water quality and doing the right thing for the farm. And we just had to find a market so we could make money doing oats, and we realized that 92% of the oats today are coming from Canada, and how can we cut out the middlemen? And when you transport oats, 30% of that semi-load is hulls. So it's a byproduct that really doesn't have any value. There's some small markets for it. We'll talk about those later. But today, we just wanted to cut out the middlemen, cut out some of the transportation barriers, and build our own mill so that we can control a stable market for us going forward. Like, one of my roles at Green Acres Milling is to sell our end product. And our end product is oat flakes, oat flours, and oat groats. And think of granolas, think of the kernels in trail mixes, and think of flour such as oat milk as an example. We're going to be all domestic oats. We're going to be gluten-free. The four crops that have gluten are wheat, barley, triticale, and rye. And most farmers in my area or invested in this mill don't really grow wheat, barley, or rye. Yeah, you can do rye as a cover crop, but don't really let it go to head or to seed, because then we'll have some issues. So we can be really confident that we'll be gluten-free when a lot of other mills also mill barley or wheat. So they struggle to be gluten-free. And right now there's not a trend, but the celiac disease, there's concerns around gluten in the marketplace. So I think there's going to be a trend towards gluten-free going forward. And we're able to meet those demands too.
I think that's really interesting because for years, people have been telling farmers, and farmers have been saying, yeah, I'd like to have a third crop. I'd like to have a revenue producing crop, as opposed to cover crops, which unless you've maybe got livestock to graze on it or whatever, is not a per se revenue producing crop, even though you can make arguments for it's going to save inputs, fertilizer inputs, and cut back on herbicide use, that kind of thing, because of the diversity you're providing there and breaking up pest cycles. But this is a good example of an actual crop, which kind of serves the purpose of a cover crop in a way. It's building that soil health and providing those roots at a time maybe when you aren't having good roots and cover on the landscape, and providing windows for other getting maybe cover crops in later after that harvest in August or whatever, and actually getting paid for just you. It's not as much of a, how do I say this? You're not trying to just say you should do this out of the goodness of your heart, or you have to look 5 years down the road to see the benefits of it kind of thing. You can see that more immediate benefit.
Yeah, we're not leaning into cost share dollars to make oats pencil, right? Truly, it's a crop that is selling itself. We just have to produce a good product. And there's always been concerns you can't grow quality oats in southern, essentially where we're located. We've done it for a while. There's a group of farmers around here that have done oats. I've done it since 2020. And we've been able to hit specs and hit food grade quality. Like, I think that's a myth that you can't do it here. Mm-hmm. Yes, Canada oats typically have really good test weights and can hit specs without question. We can do it too. It's just we don't try. Oats in the past have been known as a nurse crop on your alfalfa fields, and you don't really fertilize them. You don't ever fungicide them. You don't really plant them to the right population. You just throw them out there. And we're doing it differently. We're getting them an inch and a half in the soil when we plant them, and we are, you know, I'm putting 30 to 40 pounds of nitrogen out there, a bunch of phosphorus and potash. Actually, this year, kind of a fun story, I'm switching over to chicken litter. Actually, it's called brood litter. I wanted to close the loop or do upcycling, what food companies like to call it. So I'm buying litter from poultry barns that I'm going to use to fertilize my oats. Next year, when we have the mill up and running, I want to sell them oat hulls that they can use as bedding. Today they do that, not always, but sometimes, instead of wood shavings. So I want to sell them oat hulls and then buy it back, you know, 8 weeks later and use that as fertilizer for my oat fields. I've heard of really good results so far. And then that way it's kind of the full circle. It's a cute story, especially for food companies, of the upcycling or recycling.
Yeah, and it's closing that loop. Yeah. I mean, and that's such a key issue. We're sitting here north of Rochester, southeast Minnesota, no secret, has a major nitrate problem in its water. And so anything we can do to close that nutrient cycle is just so key.
Yeah. Consumers like my wife, the millennial mom buying groceries from the store, care about locally sourced, care about less synthetic fertilizer, less chemical use, and I'm trying to mimic that on my farm and grow food on my farm. This year, I also did sunflowers on my farm, well, technically last year, 25. The company, the granola mix sitting right in front of us at the kitchen table here, 7 Sundays, they are buying sunflowers locally, and we're trucking them up to Prez, Minnesota. Schmoody Oils turning them, they're pressing them for oil, and then the byproduct, 7 Sundays buys and turns into sunflower cereal or sunflower protein, and they're getting those sunflowers right here from Minnesota.
What did you say? There's 134 farms?
135 farmers.
135 farmers who have signed up. And if they, you know, I don't know what they would average per farm, how many acres they might raise, but that would have you're starting to have a significant impact on what the landscape looks like a little bit.
We're going to source around 40,000 acres of oats from the furthest a guy's trucking it is 6 hours. But most of the guys are within an hour or two of Albert Lea, Minnesota. But 40,000 acres is pretty significant when it comes to oats because that's fairly small in the supply chain today. We don't have near that kind of acreage today All right. I think around here in Rochester, there's about 60 guys planting, and it was close to like maybe 7,000 acres. So now we're going up to 40,000. There's room where maybe we double down the road at the oat mill. If this hits and takes off like it should, like we're planning, there's room to double. And where I see value, like as a Minnesota taxpayer, we care about 10,000 lakes, right? It's on our license plates. Read it every day. We're spending money as taxpayers on cost share programs such as cover crops and grade stabilization structures. And like maybe we should consider more of an oat crop that, right? I've talked about the benefits where you plant it early, you harvest it early, you get an awesome window for a cover crop to go or like a hay crop to grow afterwards. Maybe we should focus more of those dollars into something like that. In return, we just get water quality benefits, right? And for oat crop, I need 30, 40, 50 pounds of nitrogen to grow it. It is a grass crop compared to 200 for corn, right? There's a lot less risk for nitrate leaching when we're dealing with oats.
Yeah, and it really starts to look good when you start interseeding, say, clover in there, that kind of, which fixes nitrogen for folks who aren't aware of that. And so you are really reducing how much nitrogen fertilizer you're relying on.
Yeah. And then the next year, if you do that clover, like last year, I no-tilled my corn into my previous clover stand from the year before where I had oats. And it worked out terrific. I think I reduced my nitrogen probably 60 pounds. I can't remember now, but there's other benefits than just you know, your oat yield, as an example. You get opportunities for soil health in return.
One question I have is, so historically, like we alluded to, oats were a big part of the rotation, particularly when people had horses on the farm, frankly, horsepower was a big part of it. And it has, you know, for a lot of reasons, both for federal policy reasons and marketing reasons and maybe even a little bit of weather shifts and all of that, for oats and small grains fell out of favor as part of the rotation in this part of the Midwest. How big of a challenge has it been for these farmers who are now invested in this, literally, enough that they're going to be really seriously raising oats, for them to, I guess, adapt, learn how to use the equipment, learn how to raise that stuff, how to harvest it, because it's out, it's a crop, but it's different than corn and beans or a row crop in general, yeah, kind of thing.
I'm glad you asked that. If you give farmers a market, they will figure it out. They are engineers at heart. They dream about stuff that most people can't believe you even think about. They will figure it out. I didn't know anything about harvesting oats my first year. I had an old John Deere 4400 combine. I spent more time unplugging the combine than I did actually harvesting oats. Yeah, there's learning pains with everything. Starting is the hardest part. So I'm not concerned. Farmers will figure it out. There's enough resources out there. There's groups. We get together quite often as a group where we talk about some of the pros and the cons and the do's and the don'ts. With our network of 130-some farmers, we're willing to share amongst each other. We've given 3-year contracts to these farmers for their, you know, for them to grow oats for the next 3 years at a set price. So there's no competition between us. We all want to grow good oats, high quality, so that the mill succeeds. So there's a lot of cross collaboration amongst our group, which it's today farming has kind of created itself into a competition of let's compete against our neighbors. And that's not the case with this oat mill. We're all trying to succeed, and we hope it takes off, right? We would love to have more oat acres out there. And I talked to a guy today over in Laverne, Minnesota. He was talking to his grandpa, and they did 125 bushel oats back in the 70s. So it's kind of funny, like, that's what I'm doing now, and that's what they did in the 70s. Imagine if we actually put some thought into it, what we can do with oat yields down the road.
I think that's an really important point. In some ways, it's a perfect storm of things coming together in good timing in that. So I remember when the University of Minnesota had an oat breeder, and then when he retired, they didn't replace him. And so for the past several years, there really hasn't been that support through, say, the traditional U of M extension system or whatever for a crop like this. But what's maybe replaced that a little bit is this huge interest in soil health. Oats was seen as one aspect of that. It was like a gateway practice or a gateway crop into building soil health by diversifying your system. And in order for that to be supported and to get the word spread, it relied on farmer-to-farmer education. And there, this area, is there's a really strong group of, couple strong groups of farmers who have been in, sharing that information. So it wasn't like you came in, built this plant, and then said, okay, start raising a crop you're completely unfamiliar with. They, a lot of them were familiar with it already as a soil health practice. Maybe they didn't, weren't getting the lucrative market that they needed for it, and maybe they were, they had livestock they could feed it to or whatever, but now they're familiar with it, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And when I started 5 years ago, you know, Martin Larson called me. I called him for some different reason, and he said, you want to grow oats? And I said, sure, I'll try anything once. Oatly at that time was offering contracts with us. Mm-hmm. You know, a year later, with it, it didn't work out because of the transportation logistics of COVID. Mm-hmm. But they kind of helped spark the oat interest in Southeast Minnesota, South Central, Southeast Minnesota, and got me going and realized oats are fun and easy. Well, not really easy, but they're fun to grow, breaks up your harvest season.
I don't want this to be the oat hour and just talk about oats, although I think it's a really, to me, it's an important example of how to diversify. It's like I said, it can be a gateway crop. It's one we have a history with. We know that there are markets out there, so it's a really great, it's just a great entryway. But I guess I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how, looking beyond oats, how this maybe could be an entryway to more, because we don't ever want to get too fixated on a silver bullet.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, the oat, people could decide all of a sudden they don't want oats in any way, shape, or form, and then there we are. But how can this model or this serve as a model or an example of how to diversify agriculture in a profitable way?
How I think about it, right? So today I have food grade oats in my rotation. What comes next? So food grade sunflowers I did this year, right? And then I'm talking to a company about food grade soybeans going forward. And then the other thing I'm thinking, so food grade soybeans, let's just close the loop on that quick, right? Soy milk is popular. Tofu is really popular. That company was looking to just buy soybeans here, clean them, and then send them over to Asia. And that's where the market is, which is great and fun. But I kind of believe in local aspect of it. So that didn't excite me very much. And I know me personally, I haven't been a part of any soybean programs. But there's been some failures in the past that have shocked some farmers and really strained them for cash. So I don't want to get too excited over soybeans as an example. I don't really like what they do for my rotation just because there's high risk for erosion. There's not a lot of crop residue out there. Mm-hmm. And the only thing, only time I'll ever use the word hate is when it comes to erosion. It's the only thing I hate is erosion. So for me to think about markets and other crops, it's an exciting time because I do feel that millennial mom, the 35-year-olds down to 28-year-olds, do care about what we're talking about. The locally sourced, healthy food trend that's happening, and whole grains, and some of the new startup food companies we're seeing more of are these type of people, the millennial mom type mindset, and they do care about buying locally and sourcing their ingredients from the same state that they have their business in. Realizing that freight is a barrier, how can we mitigate some freight? So I encourage farmers to think outside the box. Don't stick with the norm. Let's look for opportunities. And, you know, one of my roles with this oat project, oat mill, is that piece, right? I'm going to track data for these farmers so that we can tell our farmer story. But 2 of the 3 years, we don't have a market for the crop that they're growing. Let's think about a market. Maybe it's peas. Pea protein's popular right now. Let's think about other crops that we can find a home for on some of those acres.
Yeah, I really like that. It's this idea that no matter what the crop is, if we can start thinking about raising something as a food, that opens a whole nother, because you may raise oats 1 year for a food processor, but maybe as part of your rotation, that they connect you with, oh, well, we also need this ingredient or that ingredient. And so then the next year you're raising sunflowers or something else that's part of that rotation. So it's this, it's not that specific crop that's the magic bullet per se. It's the idea that I'm raising a food, I'm raising food, and it could be a number of different crops.
Yeah, I just feel there's a disconnection in today's space where food companies, they want to meet farmers, and Farmers want to meet food companies, but the middlemen are in the middle kind of blocking the whole transaction. Let's get rid of that mindset and actually try to go back to do, you know, what we talked about, grow food. You know, today the industry is built for corn and soybeans, right? Super large corn planters. How fast can you plant? How fast can you harvest? These massive combines that, you know, having four trucks can't even keep up with you if you're trying to harvest a field. So we've built the industry to be efficient and fast. You know, that's not always the answer. Like, I'm 36, I own an 80-acre farm, I would love to get more land, but then if I get more land, then I need a semi, and then I need a bigger combine. So there's barriers to that, too, where I'm not sure if it's worth paying $15,000 an acre to buy more land. That's just be more productive, and not just productive, but profitable on the land I do have, rather than, I would rather spend more time trying to find the right crops to grow than growing more crops as kind of the trend, in my mind.
Profitability has so been tied into mass production, kind of the gross.
Yeah.
And so high yields don't always necessarily, of corn, say, for example, produce high income. You know, that's kind of been a hard thing to get our minds around, that we've tied that those are so closely aligned right now. And it's this, well, what are you getting? How much inputs are you putting into that bin-busting yield? And really, what is your profit at the end rather than, well, as long as I'm getting a certain yield, then that's going to produce a certain profitability. It's not always the case at all. Often it's the opposite.
I won't blame any farmer for what they're doing or how they've got to the place they are. A lot of these farms have done this system for a long time, and they paid for it. They put their kids in college, always had a meal at the table at the end of the night. So the strategy's worked. I don't know if that's the right strategy going forward, but it has worked. So I'm not pitying or faulting anyone. I know that me personally, I don't really want to be a big farmer because I know that once you get in, it's kind of all consuming. Yeah. Where it's a bear cat when you get kind of, you know, pretty big. Then you got to start hiring people, and then you got to deal with more breakdowns. And no offense to hired labor, but we all know how that is. It's right. A bear cat. Yeah, I don't blame any farmer because the trend has been let's get big or get out. And I actually think a president said it back in what, 70s or whatever year that was. One other comment on that note was not all large farms are bad, right? They're doing good things, and we are being more efficient with the tools we have today. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just not the choice I'm making.
Talking about food, one of the things that you were talking before we recorded here was you have learned so much about kind of how small that community of food ingredients is, or even different things that food that a crop can be used for. And I think I find that exciting because it is another way of kind of diversifying how you see yourself, what you're raising for. You're not, and it's not just probably the typical, you go, well, I'm raising oats for oatmeal, or I'm raising sunflowers for a certain oil or whatever. But there is just, it has gotten to be a very complex world out there. And there's right now a real interest in high protein foods, that kind of thing. But that offers some real opportunities. And farmers don't need to be aware of all of that, but they need to maybe somehow be connected with somebody who is aware of that and can take advantage of that.
Yeah, with my role now selling our flakes, flour, and groats to food companies, I'm learning a pile, right? And one ingredient we're talking about is the byproduct, the hulls, right? 30% of your semi-load is a byproduct, and it's just the shell of the oat, the hull. Today, you're not making much money on it. You're just trying to get rid of it because, you know, if I take in 15 trucks a day, I got, what, 5 of them that I need to get rid of oat hulls. They take up space. So I was at a Lime Springs gas station at Casey's down there, and I started talking to a trucker. Oh, where are you heading? Oh, an hour north of the cities. Oh, what are you doing? Or what are you trucking? He said, oat hulls. I said, funny, that's the business I'm in. Where are you going and what are they doing? And they're turning them into a filler for a cookie product. And then I actually called that company today, and they are creating oat fiber from the oat hulls, our byproduct, and it's food grade. And yes, some companies are cookie buyers. She didn't know all the companies that are buying their products, but it's just interesting to learn what is being made from some of our products that I'm not even aware of. And this oat fiber, if you read the back of a food label, that's what it's going to be. And she says it's in a lot of protein powders and protein bars as fiber. And then my wife, she's big into nutrition. She sees a trend coming where a lot of folks are focused on high protein today, and we're lacking the fiber mindset. And some of them are having some bowel problems or gut problems because they're lacking the fiber. And one thing oats can provide is high protein and high fiber. So I do think the trend for oats will continue. I mentioned the gluten before, but mostly because of the nutritional value of oats with some of the other benefits such as fiber are going to help us grow the trend. Today in Europe, they're eating like 27 pounds per capita. The U.S. is at like 5 or 6 pounds per capita. So we have it's about an 8% trend positive, which is good, but 8% of 6 pounds is what, 0.8 or something like that? It's pretty small. So it's not a quick growth, but I do think it's going to grow, and it is a healthier option for a lot of Americans.
Well, there's a good argument for striking up a conversation at a gas station. You never know what you're going to learn.
Opportunity,
yeah. One of the things I wanted to touch on was, if you had any, and from your own experience and kind of the farmers you also work with, if you've kind of got any advice or ideas around how a farmer can reduce their, I guess, their risk when they diversify. Because like you said, there's a good reason the Midwest is covered in corn and beans. It's in some ways a low risk endeavor if you look at it from crop insurance programs, government programs you can qualify for. But then also, you know, even if the price is low, the elevator is going to take your corn and beans. You know, you don't have to deal with distributing it on your own and all of that, and finding your own markets. What are some kind of low-risk options for getting in there and figuring out if this is something that's going to work for your operation? Have you seen some kind of trends out there and seen some examples where people have been able to do that? And I guess you've seen it on your own farm here.
I do think there is a trend growing where, like, Seven Sundays has got contracts for sunflowers, and we're going to eventually have contracts for oats. So I do think there's a trend coming where there is more opportunity to find niche crops. There's risk with all of them. Like, for me to do 14 acres of sunflowers, I had to go buy a sunflower head because there's no local farmer that has a sunflower head. It was a 653 all-crop head that I had to go 2.5 hours away to Wisconsin to get. You know, that took most of the value out from making any money on sunflowers, but I took the risk because I'm hoping to grow more sunflowers down the road. I don't know if I have the solution to, like, hey, what should you farmers do to reduce risk or to find alternative crops? I would say pay attention to the markets and opportunities that are out there, especially with food companies, because I do think there's Minnesota-based ones that care and are looking for growers that want to try a different crop. Buckwheat, I've been hearing more of them. I don't know any farmers that are doing buckwheat or black beans, but I think there's opportunities that are growing.
Speaking of risk and all of that, what is the situation of, like, for crop insurance for, say, something like oats or a small grain like that?
Absolutely, one of the barriers is crop insurance. So for oats, right, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was around, I paid $8 an acre for 72 yield for my oats. And my oat goal is around 110 bushels of the acre, and then 80% of 72. So it's not very good math to have crop insurance on oats because it's based off of essentially feed grade oats at Chicago Board of Trade, which is like $350. So terrible price, terrible yield, right? But you need to build your T yield back up. So that's why I have the crop insurance. It'll probably never pay. We're trying to work similar to like organic contracts, food grade contracts, to get it based off what our food grade contracts are versus what Chicago Board of Trade is. So then it is worthwhile for farmers to have a contract or have crop insurance. I know for my sunflowers, I had to have like a letter written by two experienced crop consulting people to get crop insurance on sunflowers because I was like the only guy in Dodge County who ever applied for sunflower crop insurance.
What other challenges are there for farmers who want to diversify other than maybe the lack of markets? What are some other things that people need to overcome? Because I don't want to make this sound too easy and just,
everybody
should do it. It works great. Everybody should do it. And, you know, but what are the other challenges? Because you must see that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Grain drill, right? If you're corn and soybeans, you have no purpose to have a 7.5-inch grain drill and preferably no-till grain drill to drill in oats. So that's one barrier to equipment. And you got to harvest the oats. And if you want to be like me and make the straw, you're probably going to swath them. And swathers are, you don't even see those at auctions anymore. That's how obsolete they are. So you need to, swathers potentially. A lot of guys, if you're large-scale oat farming, you're going to take it with a soybean head. Auger or draper head work. So the equipment piece. Yeah. I personally am going to probably invest in a grain drill. I've already invested in a dummy head for the combine. And then I do have one neighbor who owns a swather still. So I hire him to swath for me. So those are some of the barriers. Like I did sunflowers this year. Planted them with the same corn planter I use, John Deere 7000, with the finger units. I was able to make the sunflower seeds work. The one thing, though, is there's not many. I'm trying to transition to organic, but I'm not there yet. I did spray my sunflowers, but there's very limited options for herbicide on sunflowers. So I pulled out a 6-row cultivator out of a guy's fence line that hasn't been used in 20 years and tried to cultivate. First time ever I've actually cultivated before between the sunflower rows to manage some of my weeds. So there's no silver bullet. There's no easy button, right? It is going back to different strategies that most of our parents or our grandparents have done to farm in the past too. So it's not easy. And today, traditional farming with corn and soybeans has become pretty easy, right? There's chemicals for everything. There's corn planters that are more expensive than most mortgages that can get the job done. You use them for 2 weeks a year, and you know they're more expensive than your house. So, yeah, it's just one of the, you know, that's what we're dealing with today.
So I was wondering, when you're on your own farm here, this is the time of year when farmers plan, and when you're doing a complex rotation, you're planning several years ahead. What can you take us a little bit through your decision making process for setting up a rotation a little bit? I hope you think about it, but yeah,
I do. Don't make fun of me. I'm not a traditional guy, so I have 70 tillable acres on my home farm here, which is an 80, and I have a contract where I have to deliver 7,000 bushels of oats annually to the seed house or to the mill. So I need to figure out how to continuously do oats on oats on oats on my farm, or I need to rent more ground, which I don't know if I want to do. So I don't know if I can answer your question about what's the best rotation. I can tell you that I'm going to figure out what works on my farm to raise food grade crops, and oats are one of them. And I'm gonna for sure do cover crops after oats to break that grass on grass rotation, because I will try oats on oats with essentially clover or whatever interseeded or a 10-way cover crop mix interseeded that the cows will graze, and then hopefully use the less synthetic fertilizers with oat hull fertilizer from the poultry barns. So I don't know if I can answer any more than I'm going to learn.
Actually, that does answer my question, because, and I didn't ask it well, but you answered the question that I meant to ask, which is, when you're planning, what lens are you looking through? And the lens you're looking through is, how does this fit into me producing food grade crops? And rather than, how do I produce a massive quantity of raw commodities or whatever? But it's through that lens of food grade. So what mix, what rotation will work for me to, in the end, have a marketable product for food?
One thing I've been thinking more of, too, and I challenged a nutritionist on this, too, is how we can use, I'll have byproducts from the oat mill, lights and thins, so 8% of the semi-load is going to be oats that don't meet test weight, lights and thins, some people call them screenings, that I might bring back home and feed to my cattle. And then instead of using corn in a steer stuffer, which is pretty traditional, you know, corn's essentially it's a byproduct we're using to feed cattle, how we can use oats instead of corn. And if you look at like the ingredients label or the nutritional value panel of corn versus oats, I think oats are better in pretty much every category, but for some reason the industry doesn't use oats. They use corn. So we've just created a system that doesn't really make sense to me, and I'm going to try to break it and figure out what works for me and is more economical. Corn, like, right, it's the easy button, corn's king. You know, I can drive within 10 miles of my farm and sell it to about three or four different companies. Anyone will buy it. But it isn't the best for the environment either, right? It can sequester a lot of carbon. I don't know many crops that grow from, you know, below ground to 6 feet high in 5 months. That, you know, it's pretty incredible what they do and how we can plant it so close. But there's erosion risks with how we seed prep the soil. So I'm concerned about that. I do think there's alternatives to the traditional model that we've created today as an industry.
So we started this conversation kind of talking about this overarching idea of how to make soil health pay, how to make it pay off financially. But I want to go back to the basics a little bit here. So we're on, like I said, we're in southeast Minnesota. We're about 8 miles north of Rochester. We're in the heart of that area, that karst area, where they've had so much problems with groundwater quality and nitrates in the groundwater. Erosion is an issue. And like you said, that's one thing. That's where you'll use the hate word, is you hate erosion. Have you seen, since you started kind of putting in place this diverse rotations and building that soil, have you seen some impacts as far as your soil health and your right here on your piece of ground here?
Yeah, I don't see the erosion. Like when I bought the farm, it was corn, soybeans, and it's hard to describe it, but I can see my soil sticking together and holding together more. Mm-hmm. Aggregate structure. Yes, I've done some Haney soil samples, but we all know the barrier with them is sometimes they're hard to read. I don't even know what I'm reading with them. And I do remember the first time I bought the farm, the agronomist came out here and he brought one of those pedometers, I believe is called, to measure compaction. And he says, you need to do deeper tillage to break up this compaction pan. And he was right to an extent, do deeper tillage. But instead of doing it mechanically with a chisel plow, I did it with ryegrass and turnips and radishes. Mm-hmm. I did it a different strategy. And now I actually have, I own a pedometer, and I don't see the compaction issues. And I farm with old equipment, right? And I'm not running across it and pounding it. You know, I kind of am sensitive to when I do equip or when I do my passes out there. It's dry conditions. Yeah, my soil health is, and I've been religious on doing cover crops. And I sometimes say bad things about cover crops, but I do believe they have a place as long as you can make them work in your rotation. And as long as you're not doing it for a government check, then there's value in them. Right? You have to be a believer in them, not just waiting for a check in the mailbox.
For more on how small grains and other so-called alternative crops can help build soil health while diversifying and fortifying a farmer's financial bottom line, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 392, at landstewardshipproject.org. There you'll find links to LSP small grains meetings and workshops. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.